thank you very much for coming to our Federalist Society Las Vegas chapter luncheon. We really appreciate you coming out. It's a special event, by far the largest, best attended of our luncheons. And we're really honored that Judge Kadish and Tao are joining us today. And we're going to show the country, this is being videotaped, how civilized and collegial a race for the Supreme Court of a state can be. And, you know, here in Nevada, we do things a little differently than they do in Washington, D.C., and I think this event will show that. Just a few words about the Federalist Society. There's information on your tables about the group. The Federalist Society is a national lawyers organization. It has over 60,000 lawyers that are members of it, and over 80 cities have chapters like this. It's dedicated to a belief in the separation of powers in our Constitution, and that judges should decide what the law is, not what it should be. It provides a forum of people with opposing views and a thoughtful and considered reflection of legal issues before us. There's a National Lawyers Conference that's scheduled for November this fall in Washington, D.C. Some of us here are going to be going to that. If you need all of your CLE to be handled in one fell swoop, that's a great place to go, and it's a tremendously interesting place to go and hear incredibly interesting lawyers, judges, and people you see on TV talk about legal issues. And now I want to talk just a little bit about our moderator of this event, Mark Hutchison, Lieutenant Governor Hutchison. I think almost all of us know Mark from his extensive history in Las Vegas legal community. He was born in Las Vegas, attended high school here at Bonanza High School, went to Brigham Young University where he got his law degree. He clerked for Kenneth Ripple, United States Court of Appeals for the Seventh Circuit, and after that he worked as an attorney for Kirkland and Ellis, starting his own firm, Hutchison and Steffen, in 1996. And after a renowned and celebrated career as a private practitioner, he decided to dip his toe into politics, became a state senator, and then the lieutenant governor, and then I guess he's removing the toe from those waters and is going back into private practice full time. And thank you very much, Lieutenant Governor, for being with us today.
Thank you. Matt, thank you very much. It really is wonderful to be here. And this is a great tribute to both of these wonderful judicial candidates who we have here, that this is a sellout crowd and everybody's interested in this race. Everybody's here. I will just underscore what Matt said about how collegial and professional that this forum will be, and this little get-together and discussion and debate, if you want to call it that. We made very clear to both candidates, very clear, that neither one of them had to bring their yearbooks today. So we're going to keep it as collegial and professional and relevant as possible. So you all know just how blessed we are, and I mean that. I use that word selectively. Blessed we are to have two candidates of this high quality for office. When you run for public office and when you get involved in public life, you realize that there are those who are very qualified and you're very happy to serve with, and those who maybe aren't so much so. And so when you get opportunities for these kind of judicial races with these level of candidates, it's just truly a blessing for Nevadans. Let me just begin by introducing Judge Kadish, who we all know. Judge Kadish graduated magna cum laude from the University of Pennsylvania in 86. She received her Bachelor of Arts degree there with honors in political science, and then she went on to the University of Virginia Law School, graduating in 1989, where she was a member of the Virginia Law Review and a member of the Order of the Coif, awarded that distinction and that honor in law school. After graduation, then she moved to Las Vegas, and the purpose of which was to clerk for Judge Pro. As we know and love Judge Pro, she came here and was an important part of Judge Pro's efforts on all our behalf. She then entered private practice, and that's where I first got to know Judge Kadish. She was a commercial litigator with Hell Lane. She worked there for 12 years, beginning in 1995 all the way through 2007. In 2000, she became a shareholder there at the Hell Lane firm, and then in 2007, she was appointed by Governor Jim Gibbons to fill the seat when Judge Bonaventure left the bench, and she assumed that position then in August of 2007 after Judge Bonaventure left the bench and has been in Department 6 ever since. She was convincingly reelected, or I should say, elected in her own right in 2008 and then reelected in 2014. Judge Kadish is a person who's been always involved in the community. She was president of the Southern Nevada Association of Women Attorneys from 2004 to 2006, and she remains an active member in that organization. She also is a master in the Howard D. McKibben Inner Court and an active member in the local chapter of the Federal Bar Association, as well as serving and being involved in the American Bar Association and the Clark County Bar Association. She also served as the lawyer representative for the United States District Court, acting as the liaison between the court and members of the bar. She's taught various seminars and been active in various forums and presentations on numerous topics, particularly litigation and with the end of courts. And so I hope you'll welcome and join me in welcoming Judge Kadish. Next is someone who is equally well known and a judge in our district court for many years and now serves on the Court of Appeals. We all know Judge Tao, who currently is a member of the Court of Appeals, and he was appointed to that position in December of 2014 by Governor Brian Sandoval. Prior to that time, Governor Sandoval had appointed Judge Tao to serve as a district court judge in 2011 on the 8th Judicial District Court. Like Judge Kadish, Judge Tao ran for election himself and was convincingly elected in 2014 and then reelected in 2016 in a very convincing fashion. Previously, he served as Clark County Deputy District Attorney and Chief Deputy Public District Attorney and as a civil attorney in private practice. He's been very active in the community as well, with various organizations, including Leadership Las Vegas, Focus Las Vegas, the UNLV Vice President's Commission on Diversity, and also serves as an adjunct professor at the Boyd Law School on trial advocacy. In 2017, Judge Tao was elected to the American Law Institute, the leading and independent organization in the United States for producing scholarly work to clarify, modernize, and improve the law. And by participating in the Institute's work, Judge Tao feels that he has a very strong influence to help develop the law in both existing as well as emerging areas of the law. Judge Tao is a graduate of Cornell University, 1989, and George Washington University Law School in 1992, where he served on both the Law Review as well as the Moot Court Board. Please join me in welcoming Judge Tao.
You can.
Mark, do I have to give you a kiss too?
You can. Listen, started off with a bang here. All right. Well, judges, again, thank you very much for being here, and I hope we can touch on some subjects that I think we're all interested in. But let me just begin, and I'll start with just some questions for you, just on your own personal life and just kind of why you're doing this. You always get this question. Why don't you give us maybe a one-minute answer in terms of why you're running for the Supreme Court and what you hope to accomplish as a member of the court. Judge Kadish? Yeah, no, we'll just rotate back and forth. And we're not going to put a time limit on answers, but if you start the filibuster, we'll move you along. All right?
Perfect. Thank you so much. So I like to call myself a law geek. I like the law. I enjoyed law school. I like analyzing legal issues. I've enjoyed having the opportunity to rule on some complex, difficult, and important issues as a district judge. And I look forward to working on those issues on our Nevada Supreme Court. It's obviously important to have folks on that court who are going to put in the time to do the research, review the record in detail, and rule based on the facts and the law. I believe I've shown in the last 11 years that I have those skills. That's how I approach my cases, and that's what I look forward to doing. I also think that we need to work on reducing the time it takes to get a ruling from our Nevada Supreme Court, and I would like to...
I'll applaud that one.
We also need to work on getting some more published decisions out so we have some more guidance. Unfortunately, now we end up with a lot of inconsistency in the rulings from our different district judges because we don't have guidance from our Supreme Court in so many areas. So I look forward to participating in making those decisions. I think I have the skills and the temperament to do so, and I look forward to being part of the court.
Thank you, Judge Cates. Judge Chow.
First of all, let me thank all of you. I love coming to the Federalist Society. As many of you know, I've been a member for a few years now, and really love this organization because it's a place, like Judge Cates, I'm a super law nerd. Anyone who's read my opinions knows that I cite more law review articles and treatises and obscure references than just about any other judge in the state. And because I love the law, I'm literally the guy who reads law review articles for fun in my spare time because I think I think they're interesting. And this is an organization where you can engage in conversations about those obscure things. In fact, a few minutes ago, Matt Saltzman and I were standing at the door and we had a short conversation. We know that you can be a textualist without also being an originalist, but can you really be an originalist without also being a textualist, which may be the nerdiest conversation two people have ever had in their lives. But it's the kind of conversation that you can have here and that this organization really encourages. So many of my reasons for running for the Supreme Court are very similar. We all know that the Nevada Supreme Court is the highest level court in town. And it has had issues that, honestly, the Court of Appeals has helped to address. In 2014, the Nevada Supreme Court had the biggest backlog of any Supreme Court in the country, 3,000 cases. The average time to disposition was 3 years, which is more than twice the national average. The establishment of the Court of Appeals has helped bring that down, but the time to disposition is still on the high side. We're still above the national average. And as Alyssa pointed out, because of the volume, the Supreme Court doesn't publish on as many things as they need to. In fact, those of you who are in commercial litigation know that in 2016, the Nevada Supreme Court finally got around to publishing an opinion that set forth the elements of a breach of contract claim in Nevada. After 150 years, we finally had that opinion out. And there's many, many other issues that the Supreme Court needs to publish on, and it's a time problem. I'm on the Court of Appeals now, and we're experiencing the same time problem. On our court, we're averaging, we dispose of 1,000 cases a year. That comes out to 4 a day. That really limits what you can actually publish on, and when you do publish, it limits what you can say. I can bang out a 10-page opinion half the time it takes to do a 50-page opinion, but the 50-page opinion might have been a lot more helpful. So I think we're both running for a lot of the same reasons. I think I have the advantage in that in the Court of Appeals, one of the things we've done is we've implemented a number of procedures over the last couple of years through a lot of trial and error. We experimented with things, we tinkered with rules, we tried some things that were failures, but at least we know they're failures now. And hopefully, if I get on the Supreme Court, I can show what we've done and what we come up with that will help, I think, dispose of some cases and kind of help that problem out.
Great. Thank you, Judge. Let me address what is a pressing issue that we've all been fixated on the last couple days, and that's this whole U.S. Supreme Court, and it's really raised the view of the U.S. Supreme Court in the eyes of all Nevadans and all Americans. But let's not talk about the U.S. Supreme Court. Let's really talk about the Nevada Supreme Court and really what you see and what your philosophy is and what your view is of the role of the Nevada Supreme Court in our governmental system here in Nevada, as well as within society in general in the state of Nevada. Judge Tao, we'll start with you. 1 minute, please.
So let me start with a story that I think will resonate with some of the people here. One of the founding stories of this society goes like this. Many years ago, a young law professor at the University of Chicago named Antonin Scalia was having a conversation with a young law student named Leonard Leo, who is now the executive vice president of the National Society. And in the conversation, then Professor Scalia made the observation that he believes one of the big mistakes that the Supreme Court made during the Warren Court years was that it focused way too much on the Bill of Rights, individual liberties. Not that those are not important, but because it was so tightly focused on the Bill of Rights, it lost focus on the rest of the Constitution, including the structural guarantees in Article 1, Article 2, Article 3. And his concern is, if you look at the way he expressed it to Mr. Leo was, if you look at history, even dictatorships have long lists of rights that they give to their citizens, but they're still dictatorships and you're not free when you live there. What makes the United States different and not a dictatorship are the structural issues. The fact that the U.S. government is divided up into three co-equal independent branches of government, each within its own well-defined sphere, and also the U.S. government is one of 51 major governments in the United States along with the 50 states. And the problem with Scalia's view, one of the problems of the Warren Court was during their years of jurisprudence, they let the separation of powers and federalism issues slide a lot. You know, when I was in law school, and I imagine most of you heard, you know, basically under the latent commerce clause, anything goes. The federal government can regulate anything in the name of commerce. And that's one of the artifacts of the Warren Court years that then Professor Scalia thinks was a little bit of a mistake. So it's a long story to get to the point of, you know, my view of courts are they're one of the three independent branches of government. They are the branch of government tasked with enforcing individual liberties, but they're also the branch of government that should be tasked with enforcing the separation of powers and federalism issues. that are part of the Constitution. And, you know, and courts for many years haven't really done that. We've seen kind of a resurgence in the last decade or so at the U.S. Supreme Court level with federalism and separation of powers issues. There's this debate that's going on now with Judge Kavanaugh's nomination and last year with Judge Gorsuch's nomination about Chevron deference and how that plays into separation of powers. That's a debate that hasn't been had for many years that I think is appropriate to have and that judges should keep in mind.
Thank you, Judge. Judge Kadish, again. Role of the Nevada Supreme Court in our governmental system and in society in Nevada.
Sure. I mean, obviously, as we all learned as we were growing up in basic civics class, you learn about the three branches of government. And the role of the judiciary is to interpret and apply the law in their case. It's not their job to make the law. That's the legislature's job. It's not the job of the judiciary. So if you disagree with the way a law is written, go to the legislature and have them change it, but it's the role of the court to interpret it the best they can and apply it to the case. And obviously, our Nevada Supreme Court hears appeals in all kinds of cases. So civil, criminal, family, all the courts across our state have their appeals go to the Nevada Supreme Court. Some of those cases are pushed down to the Court of Appeals, but they need to be prepared to hear appeals in all those different areas, look at the statute in question, interpret it, apply it to the facts of the case. But of course, you have to look at what the standard of review is, depending on if it's a factual issue or a legal issue. We think we all learned what those principles are in law school, but it's pretty straightforward. That's the role of the court.
Let me just follow up. Thank you both. Let me follow up with that in terms of just how you look at statutes. And as a former legislator, how you use legislative history or legislative and legislative intent for that purpose. So both to both of you, and give us your thoughts and sort of your approach and your philosophy in terms of a statute's original intention, a statute's original meaning, and how, if at all, legislative history comes into play in interpreting that statute.
Sure. Well, all of those issues are only even looked at. They're only part of the analysis if you've looked at the statute itself and it's not clear on its face, if you can't read it and know what it means. And it's only if that's the case, if there's some ambiguity or vagueness that you have in that statute, that you look at any of those issues. Now, if that happens, then I do review legislative history. But number one, I think any lawyer who's ever tried to look at legislative history would agree it's not particularly helpful in this state, but it's worth looking at. And what I would say is the purpose to me of looking at the legislative history is to determine what the goal was of the legislature that passed the statute and implemented the law. So when what you have is summaries of testimony from some lobbyist who was there lobbying for a particular law, I don't always find that particularly helpful because that doesn't tell me what the legislators thought who passed the statute. That tells me what someone wanted who was testifying before the legislature. So I'm trying to determine the best I can what the legislature meant. Now, obviously, the words they used are important. You have to look at what the words themselves mean in the English language, and I would consider all of that as well as the context of the statute. The section you're interpreting is part of a bigger act that was passed by the legislature. You need to look at overall what they did with the different sections. Can the other sections of the act that was passed help you interpret that particular statute? Are there other decisions that give guidance from prior decisions from the Nevada Supreme Court? And if not, is it a statute that has analogous provisions in other states where you can look at those states' decisions and see what have they done, how have they interpreted it? But they're all part of the analysis that goes in, but the place to start is the statute itself, and if that's clear, then you don't need to go any further than that.
Thank you, Judge Kadish. Judge Tao?
So I'm going to go full on nerd here. Your question is, are you an intentionalist, are you a purposivist, or are you a textualist is really the question.
That's precisely my intent in asking the question.
And to a lesser extent, you know, since you talk about original meaning, are you a new originalist or an old originalist? Okay, so here's what I mean. Those are the three main schools of statutory interpretation. An intentionalist believes that you start with the plain words of the text, but if the words are ambiguous, then you go to the legislative intent with an eye to determining what the legislators, the people who drafted this statute, had in mind. A purposivist believes that you don't actually look at the intent of the legislature, but you can look at the purpose of the statute. What was the problem that this bill was designed to solve? I don't need to know what individual legislators thought, but as a group, there was a purpose, there was a problem that this statute was designed to solve. And given what the words are, and the ambiguity, what do I think the legislature's purpose was in their solution? A textualist would say, you don't look at any of that stuff because none of that stuff was actually voted on by anybody. It's just what random people say, and you don't even know if the legislature's speech during the passage of the bill represented his own views or the views of 100 other people, or it was just out of left field. And one of the criticisms that textualists would have is that when you look at legislative history, are politicians actually honest about what they're up to, right? Most people in the federal society verge toward textualism. If I were king of Nevada, I would be a textualist, but Nevada is not a textualist state. The Nevada Supreme Court is overtly an intentionalist state. They have many, many decisions in which they say you look at the legislative intention. They're not purposivists, they're certainly not textualists. But if I had my druthers, I would be a textualist. I've written actually a string of dissents and concurrences on this because there are problems. To me, the problem with being an intentionalist is it opens itself up to manipulation. Legislators can manipulate legislative history for their own ends. Politicians don't always tell the truth when they're making speeches about what's really going on or what the bill means for their state. And on the other end, the problem is a judge who is not intellectually honest, or if he's honest but he's not putting in the effort, can sometimes tend to pick and choose what he likes out of the history rather than engaging in an honest investigation of what the legislature had in mind. Ray Kethledge, who's a judge in the Sixth Circuit, has a very interesting law review article that he published about a year ago in which he talks about some of the problems with intentionalism. And one of the other problems is with intentionalism or purposivism is this. If your purpose is to look for an ambiguity in the statute, the way the human mind works, you're going to find what you're looking for. And now every statute is ambiguous. And now every statute has to be interpreted by something outside of its text. And Kethledge has some concrete examples in this law review article, in which he points out here, you know, examples of statutes that courts have found to be ambiguous, but really they're not. If you get your mind out of the role of looking for ambiguity and actually just look at the text, sometimes, and it's not your purpose to find ambiguity, sometimes the text is not ambiguous, but the fact that there's this ambiguity doctrine is sort of invites... Okay. I don't want to say abuse because I don't, you know, I think most judges that I know work hard and they try to be honest, but judges are also overworked, as we talked about with the volume of cases. And if you're short of time, sometimes just looking at legislative intent becomes a crutch that can overrule what the statute actually says.
Judge Child, thank you. It's all I can do to resist just the pleasure it would be to, for once, interrupt a judge as opposed to... So I've restrained myself and want to follow up, though, and that's not to say everything that both of you have talked about has been very enlightening and very, I think, revealing in terms of your judicial philosophy. And that's really why we're trying to attach these questions. So let me just follow up with maybe just a little bit shorter answer on public policy. And I'm going to start with you, Judge Tao, in terms of what role public policy now plays in the interpretation and the enforcement of a statute.
Well, if you're a purposivist, it plays a large role. If you're a textualist, it shouldn't play very much of a role at all. But again, Nevada is not a textualist state. I'm trying to get them to be through some of my dissents and concurrences. Don't know if I'm succeeding, but I'm trying. You know, there's a danger. Judges, you know, a lot of judges think that, you know, we went to law school, a lot of legislators didn't. We sit on the bench, we see lots of things, we know lots of things. And so we know a lot about what's going on in public policy. And sometimes you have to look at, since Nevada is an intentionalist state, sometimes you have to look at public policy. But sometimes it can be dangerous for judges to do that because we don't have the tools that legislatures have. Legislators, you know, you know how the legislature works. You can talk to people. I know lobbyist is a bad word, but lobbyists can talk to you about the effect the bills are going to have on the state. You know, groups can come to you. You can talk to experts. Judges can do none of that. I can't be lobbied. I can't talk to thousands of people on what impact my ruling is going to have on them. And so I don't have the, you know, if you think about it honestly, judges don't have the tools to even know what the rulings are going to do. And so it can be very dangerous for judges to go into the realm of policy because we may think we know a lot because we went to law school, but really we're devoid of a lot of the information that the political process actually brings out.
Thank you, Judge. Judge Kadish, public policy, the role in interpreting and enforcing statutes.
Sure. So in talking about public policy and the role for me as a member of the judiciary, my policy positions have zero to do with any decision I make as a judge. I'm not asking you to elect me as a legislator to pass the law. I'm asking you to elect me to the Nevada Supreme Court and sit as a judge on that court. So my public policy positions have zero to do with what I do as a judge. But if I'm interpreting a statute that's been passed, and if I find that it is not clear, it is ambiguous, and I need to start looking beyond the words of the statute itself, then I think it's important to understand what was the legislature trying to accomplish when it passed that. And that's where the role of policy comes in. What policy was the legislature trying to accomplish in passing that statute? That may not always answer the question, but I think it's an important part of the analysis. So that's the role that it would play in my view.
Thank you very much. Staying with you, Judge Kadish, can you give us an example of a case that you felt was particularly significant, either one that you advocated as an advocate when you were arguing before judges and actually as a judge? A case that you thought or a series of cases or one that you felt like was particularly meaningful, impactful, either in your practice or as a judge?
I think the most impactful case for me, which really drove home for me the importance of what I do every day as a judge and the importance of having a judge who is fair and impartial, is the recent case you may be familiar with involving Fred Steese. It was a criminal case against him. I had the habeas petition, and after a lengthy evidentiary hearing, I found that, in fact, Fred had been in prison for over 20 years for a murder that he did not commit. In fact, he was not even in the state of Nevada at the time the murder happened. And it's only if you have a judge who takes the time and effort to listen to everything, to consider the possibility that someone who is charged is not guilty of that charge, only if you have someone with an open mind will they be able to find that one case. I have a lot of habeas petitions that I consider and rule on and deny, but you still have to read each and every one because there's that one needle in the haystack where somebody is actually innocent. And that really drives home the importance of what I do and gives me great satisfaction.
Thank you, Judge. Judge Tao.
Yeah, that's a hard question to ask of any judge. You know, I've handled 3,000 cases in the Court of Appeals, on the district court, thousands of cases as a prosecutor, hundreds of cases. And, you know, all of them important because they're important to the people involved, and therefore they're important to me. It's hard to single one out. You know, I'd say that, probably to single it out, there's a line of cases, a line of dissents and concurrences that I've written on the Court of Appeals that, you know, I opened up by talking about separation of powers. You know, the Nevada Supreme Court to me has not been, like many courts that Scalia was referring to in that initial conversation, has not been, I think, as attentive to separation of powers issues as it should have been. In fact, over the last 30 years, the Supreme Court and the appellate courts have issued only a handful of opinions on separation of powers, and half of them are written by me. And so I have this line of cases that I'm trying to kind of resurrect that as a thing. You know, the Nevada Constitution is not the same as the U.S. Constitution. It's actually more, it has more emphasis on separation of powers than the federal Constitution actually does, and yet our jurisprudence doesn't reflect that. So what I've been trying to do in the Court of Appeals is to kind of resurrect that. I haven't been, you know, a lot of these are dissents. I haven't been able to even gather a majority, but by throwing it out there, hopefully for the lawyers to raise in the briefs to the Supreme Court, you know, it's a shot at resurrecting restoring what I think the role of the courts should be in our state government.
Judge Tao, staying with you, can you give us your thoughts about who you admire either past or present, currently on the U.S. Supreme Court. And if you could write a bio about that person, what would you say about them?
Well, the cheap political answer would be Scalia, because he's the founder of the Federalist Society, right? But really, the one justice who I admire, who I think has been overlooked a little bit, is a guy named Robert Jackson, who served in the 40s and 50s. He's actually better known remembered now as one of the prosecutors in Nuremberg. But he wrote when he was on the Supreme Court, he wrote a number of seminal decisions that were, you know, landmark decisions. You know, Youngstown Sheet and Tube is a decision that's cited even today. The Jehovah's Witness case, West Virginia versus Barnett, is an opinion that's cited in law schools. But he's kind of disappeared in history. He never got the prominence that John Marshall or Scalia or Earl Warren or some of the other justices got. So he's a guy that, you know, if I had to write a biography, I'd pick him up because I think he's worthy of attention, but somehow is a little bit forgotten today.
Thank you, Judge. Judge Kadas.
Right, so there were sort of two questions about biography and who I admire.
Right.
Okay. So in terms of who I would be interested in researching and writing a biography about, because I would like to learn more about him, is Benjamin Cardozo, who was one of the first Jewish Supreme Court justices. And he came from, it's not the state Supreme Court, because he was in New York, so it's the New York Court of Appeals. So he was on the highest appellate court of that state.
Right.
Before moving up to the United States Supreme Court, and I have a lot of respect for him and would like to learn more about him. And in terms of who I admire on the current court, I admire someone who has overcome a lot of obstacles to get to where she is. And I gotta tell you, Ruth Bader Ginsburg is my answer. But here's the thing, it's not about the rulings that she makes. She was one of the first women to go through law school, and she was already married with children, and she was one of only 9 women in her law school class. And she had difficulty getting a job after that because she was a woman. But she didn't give up, and she kept working hard, and she has accomplished so much. And she's even overcome health obstacles in her career. I'm pretty sure she's still in better shape than I am, even at this point in her life. It's amazing when I see those videos of her still doing her exercise routine. And one of the most poignant things about her to me is that she still treats everyone with respect. And although she had lots of disagreements with Justice Scalia on the decisions they made on cases, they were still good friends. They still went out and socialized together. And that's really what we all expect from our judges, that they can have a civil conversation about legal issues and still walk out and be friends and respect each other. And that's what I admire about her.
Thank you both. Judge Kadas, starting with you. Just thinking back, and we're talking about the U.S. Supreme Court justices, thinking back on all the U.S. Supreme Court decisions, this is for you as well, Judge, as well. Is there any one decision, or it wouldn't have to be the most impactful or one you think is most important, but discuss a U.S. Supreme Court decision that you think has been particularly impactful on society and the role the court played in that decision?
Right. So I go back to Marbury versus Madison, 1803. Obviously, the concept of judicial review that came out of that decision influences everything that came after. Our entire system of checks and balances, and the idea that the court can find that an act passed by the legislature is unconstitutional and void, I think is the most important decision the Supreme Court made, lays the foundation of everything that's happened since, and the whole way we think about our system of government, that the legislature, if they start passing a law that is not in conformance with our constitutional principles, it can be stricken down by our courts.
Thank you. Just how?
Yeah, that's a hard question. You know, Marbury is important. I mean, there's a long string of decisions that have really helped shape our society. Brown versus Board of Education, West Virginia versus Barnett, which is the religious liberty case. There's a long string of them. I'm going to kind of turn that question around a little bit. I'm going to talk about a case that very, very few people have actually heard of, but I think is actually a case that really needs a little bit more attention. I mentioned earlier that in Judge Kavanaugh and Judge Gorsuch's nomination process, there was some talk about the administrative state. One of the worst Supreme Court decisions I think that ever came out that no one even knows about is this case called Chenery II. It's SEC versus Chenery Corporation from 1947. I'm going to tell you why I think it matters. It actually matters because it came up in a case that came up in front of our court about a year ago, and I wrote a dissent in it. So here's the facts of our. I'm trying to keep this short, but here's the facts of the case that I had. OSHA came into it's a case called Sierra Packaging versus OSHA. OSHA came into Sierra Packaging's facility, didn't like what they saw, but nothing of what they saw was actually illegal. There was no violation of any rule, statute, or regulation that OSHA had passed, and there's tons of OSHA regulations out there. OSHA sued them anyway, brought an administrative action. OSHA won in front of the ALJ. It was affirmed by the district judge. And the reason it was affirmed by the district judge is because of the Chenery case. What Chenery literally says is that even in an administrative action brought by OSHA or the EPA, even if there is no rule or statute prohibiting what you are doing, they can bring an action against you, find you guilty, and that action becomes the new rule. Now, in every other context, that would be unconstitutional for multiple reasons. There's the due process problem because you didn't know what the violation was. It's ex post facto liability. You weren't liable when you did it, but now you are, retroactively. But in the administrative context, it's okay to do. And that's a decision that's really been overlooked that has a lot of impact on people because it's what happened in the OSHA case that we had a year ago. And I wrote a long 15-page dissent in which I said, I know that you can do this under the U.S. Supreme Court case law, but it's ridiculous that you can do this, and I think it needs to be revisited. And the reason it matters in Nevada is because, as everybody knows, 85% of this state is owned by the federal government. And there's, you go down to Lake Mead, you're dealing with the U.S. Park Service, you go down to the Red Rock, you're dealing with the BLM. And according to several studies, the average citizen in Nevada is actually slightly more likely to come in contact with a federal official than citizens in most states. And the danger of a case like Chenery is when you come in contact with a federal official, you don't actually know what's illegal when you deal with them. And so that's a decision that, it's very, very obscure, and it maybe even shows a little bit of my nerdiness, but it's one that I think is extremely dangerous that is kind of hanging out there.
Thank you, Judge. What would you think about the question that I'm going to pose to you concerning the debate that we have in this state on a regular basis, and that is the appointment versus the election of the judiciary? You're both running for office. You both have been appointed to office. So you're both uniquely positioned to give us your views on appointment of the judiciary versus election of the judiciary. Judge, I think Judge Tao, it's yours, because you're the last one to talk. Yep.
Yeah, both Judge Cage and I have the advantage that we were both initially appointed and then had to run for re-election. What I'll say is this. When I went through the appointment process, I was asked some very, very difficult questions by lawyers in the room and by the Chief Justice. And then the second state, I don't know if you guys know the process, but you apply, you go in front of the Commission on Judicial Selection, which is chaired by the Chief Justice. It's got different members, some permanent, some standing, and some rotating. Half of them are lawyers, some of them are non-lawyers. During that process, I was asked some very, very detailed questions. They went through my application, they read some of the opinions I'd written, they looked at cases I worked on, they asked me very substantive, difficult questions. I then went in front of Governor Sandoval, who, unlike a lot of other governors, as you may know, was a former federal judge. He asked me a series of extremely penetrating, difficult questions about philosophy and whatnot. It was a pretty exacting process, and it had a lot to do with what kind of judge I would be. In contrast, on the campaign trail, occasionally you have organizations like this, groups of lawyers who will ask you very high-level, difficult questions, but most of your interactions aren't anything like that. You go to a Lions Club, a Kiwanis Club, a Union Hall. They might ask you general softball questions, but no one is going to ask you really detailed questions about philosophy, textualism, intentionalism, anything like that. So that, I think, is a big plus for the appointment process. Having said that, though, there's, I think, a big plus that's been overlooked with the election process, which is it does keep you in touch with what's going on in the community. You guys may remember about 15 years ago, there was a judge in San Francisco, I think, a federal judge, who declared the Pledge of Allegiance unconstitutional because it has the words "under God." It was immediately reversed on appeal, and it's become like a laughingstock decision. Now, I don't know this judge, never met him. I don't want to really throw this judge under the bus. But in my head, I can almost see, now that I've been on the bench a few years, I can almost see how this happened. Here's a guy who doesn't have to run for re-election, sits in his chambers, talks to the same five people every week, like Alyssa and I do. Our conversations with our clerks, you see the same small people in your world. And I wonder if what happened was, because he only talks to the same five or six people all week long, that none of them was strong enough to say, "Judge, that's stupid, don't do that."
Yeah.
But on the other hand, if you're forced to go out to groups like this and have conversations with people, you do get the opportunity to hear what people are concerned about, and it kind of keeps you grounded a little bit. So I think that's a big plus in favor of the election process.
Thank you, Judge. Judge Kadis.
Tough one. Right. So I have been through both processes, some positively, some not. And overall, I enjoy, I would agree with Judge Tao that it's important for us to get out and interact with people and not just live in our little, you know, bubble of the lawyers around us and not be in tune with what people are concerned about with our court system. And that is very important. But what I'm very concerned about in the election process is how many people out there have absolutely no idea who to vote for in a judicial election, or even how to decide who to vote for in a judicial election. And I'm certainly out there every day meeting people to talk to them and educate them about the process. But it's very concerning to have so many people voting without being educated about it or really understanding how to pick a judge or what makes a good judge. At least in the appointment process, someone is looking at the background and experience and qualifications of those who are applying for a judicial position, and I do appreciate that process. But certainly, each process has its flaws. Both processes have their own version of politics in a way.
Yeah.
But I'm most concerned about making sure we have qualified people on the bench, because the folks who sit in our judiciary do a very important job that affects everybody's lives every day. In a lot of ways, it really more impactful than any individual legislator, at least. And it's very difficult to have a race like this for our state Supreme Court and to have in the primary 12.5% of the population of Nevada who actually bothered to vote and voted in our race voted for none of these candidates, which I understand they probably didn't know who to vote for, but it's effectively a throwaway vote. It doesn't count for anything. It's the same as if they didn't vote in the race at all. And that's a real shame. I mean, I suppose ideally what we should do is make sure everyone's educated, so when they go to the polls and do vote, they know about all of us and do them my best to do that with the system we have.
Great. Judges, last question before we open this up for maybe the last 15 minutes or so on questions. You have both been district court judges and appellate judges who have been reversed and affirmed by the Nevada Supreme Court. How has that experience as a lower court judge influenced your view and impact your approach to district court decisions that will come up before you in terms of your analysis of those cases?
Sure, thank you. So I haven't done an actual analysis. I think I have one of the lowest reversal rates, and I appreciate, I'm trying to remember the name of the website, like, I'm not endorsing it. I don't know the people behind it. There's a website, Our Nevada Judges, that lists reversal rates for judges, and I think I had one of the lowest rates.
But probably only visited by judges.
Probably so. That's a fair point. Definitely. So here's the thing. Obviously, my goal every day when I'm making decisions is to get it right every day, and that means to correctly apply to the law, apply the law to the facts of the case before me, and that's my goal. So, of course, when I'm making that decision, I have in mind what I think is going to happen on the Nevada Supreme Court. I don't want to get reversed, not because I take personal offense to it. I appreciate the guidance that I get when that happens and it comes back to me, and okay, I got that wrong, I'll get it right going forward. I don't have a problem with that. But that whole process extends out the time for the real people involved in the case to have a final resolution of the case. So I'd rather get it right the first time. And that's what I try to do. So I suppose what it does is makes me think about our Nevada Supreme Court justices, the guidance they've given us in the published decisions, and even in unpublished decisions, to try to determine what I think Nevada law is based on that, because I don't want to get reversed.
Great. Thank you very much, Judge. Judge Tao.
Yeah, it's never personal. As Judge Cato said, the job of any judge who takes their job seriously is to get it right. And sometimes reasonable minds can just disagree on what right is. That's why we even, you know, not only do you have an appeal, but that's why on most appellate courts in the country, in the federal system, you have multiple judges, nine on the Supreme Court, because you want different minds looking at it, and people can see things, the same thing differently. And so it's never personal. You know, I know, you know, speaking for myself, it doesn't always feel good when we reverse, but, you know, you have to remember, even when we are reversed, look, it's not about me. You know, I saw this case one way, I did the best I could. I always tried, like Alyssa, I always tried to get it right the first time so I wouldn't be reversed, but when it happens, look, somebody saw the case differently, and that's how it works. And sometimes we reverse for things that, you know, I know of one case where I reversed where I actually followed existing law, but the magistrate court got it, and they decided to change the law and take it in a different direction. And that's fine. I can't do anything about that, but that's one of the things about the law, especially in the common law area. The law isn't going to stay the same forever. It can grow and change as things grow and change in the common law area. And that's what happens. It's one of the positives of the law. You know, like I said, I can't say I felt really great about it, but I understood. It's one of the things that's just going to happen. And, you know, the goal of all of us is to make sure that, you know, that we get it right. I'd like to be right every time. I know I put in the effort to get it right any time. But at the very least, if I'm going to be reversed, then systemically, as a court system, I want to make sure that we're getting it right. And if there's a reversal in the middle there, that's fine, as long as in the end the result is the fair and just result.
Judge, thank you. Judges, thank you both. I want to open it up to the floor now, but what I'd ask you to do is when you stand, make sure and state your name, and importantly, the law firm or the organization from which you come so that you will carefully consider your questions. All right.
So none of the associates here are going to ask any questions, only the partners.
That's right. All right, who's got a question? Jacob Reynolds, he's not associated with any law firm at this time. You got to speak up, Jacob.
My question is about the somewhat role of the judiciary, but recently we've had some issues with, for example, the legislature, I believe, is the true body to make law. And that means they will make law and policy decisions that hurt people. There will always be a loser on the end of the discussion in the courts, right? Someone's going to lose because the legislature made a decision. So you've talked about ways to interpret the law, but I've had a problem with judges who just think the law is unfair. Hmm.
All right, Jacob, thank you. So, judges, you get it in terms of just the fairness of the law. If the law comes before you, you don't think it's fair, you think that there's a result that ought to flow from that law that is not particularly just or is fair, what's the role of the judge? And what's your view in terms of when you're faced with that kind of a situation? Judge Tao, I think you spoke last, so we'll start with you.
At the state court level, we play different roles in depending on what kind of case it is. If it's a common law case, like a torts case, where the legislature hasn't passed any statutes, then fairness is something that judges can consider because common law is judge-made law. But your question is more directed to statutes. You're talking about if the legislature passes a statute that some people may think is unfair. My answer to that is fairness has no place in my thought process. The legislature, if they pass a statute, gets to decide what's fair through the democratic process. And just because I don't like a law, that's irrelevant. They pass the law as long as it's constitutional, as long as it's not, you know, unconstitutionally vague or something like that. My job is to enforce the law whether I like it or not, and that's just the way it is. You know, your question kind of had a couple components to it. You know, you made a comment about winners and losers. You know, every law is going to, I don't know that there are very many laws out there that everybody unanimously loves. You know, every law is going to have somebody who doesn't like it, but that's the that's how the democratic process works. Everybody votes, the majority wins, and that's how it works. And judge, it's not the role of a judge to interfere in the democratic process.
Thank you. Judge Kaye.
Right. So it's certainly not the role of the judge to decide a law is unfair according to their personal values and therefore find it unconstitutional. I think everyone in this room can agree that is not the legal process that we have in our country, and that's certainly not the process that I would follow. And I don't have in mind the particular issue that Jacob was addressing, but in Med-Mal. So obviously, it's not about fairness or unfairness. And if there's a challenge on constitutionality of a particular statute, then you'd have to look at the particular constitutional issue being raised. So if there's a due process challenge, I would have to look at the particular statute and determine, could it possibly be in violation of due process? If there's an equal protection challenge, I would have to look at whether, in fact, there is a violation of the Equal Protection Clause under the case law that we have interpreting that clause of the 14th Amendment. So certainly fairness is not the standard, or my personal view of fairness is not the standard, but I would have to look at the arguments actually made by the parties to evaluate the constitutionality of the particular statute.
Thank you. Other questions? From a room full of lawyers. Mike. Question goes to when you're running for office and there are allegations made against you, who has the burden of proof, number one, and what should the standard be? I think how can we as voters then make a decision based on those allegations and, you know, consistent with your obligation to show your fitness versus the accuser's obligation to show the proof of the accusations are accurate? Judge Kadish, we'll start with you.
Right. Obviously, I'm not going to address the Judge Kavanaugh situation particularly, but what I would say is, as a candidate for elected office, it's certainly my obligation, if I want to get elected, to convince all of you and everyone else in the state of Nevada that you should vote for me. So that's my burden when I decide to throw my hat in the ring and run for this office. Now, if some allegation were to come at me that I'm not foreseeing, I would do my best to respond to it, but it's not a criminal case. And so the same standards that apply in a criminal case don't apply in this context. Now, we all have a general sense of fairness, and we can all talk about that, but from a legal perspective, it's up to me to persuade every voter in the state of Nevada to vote for me, so that's my burden.
Thank you, Judge. Judge Tao.
Yeah, I mean, your question is an interesting one. I know that last night Senator Flake, during the Kavanaugh nominations, talked about due process and that kind of thing. But really, you know, I mean, we're all lawyers, and lawyers sometimes have a tendency to just put everything in the legalese. But really, due process isn't a thing. It's a political decision. What the Senate is engaged in right now is a political decision. it's not a court of law. There, you know, no one gets the right to an attorney. No one's being charged with anything. At the end of it, no one's going to jail. No one's getting sort of judgment entered against them. So extrapolating from the question to what I think you're asking about us, look, when we're running for office, like Alyssa and I are, this is a political election. It's what it is. I'd like to think that we live in a state where we are going to be considered by the voters on their merits, on our merits, and how good a campaign we've run, and how good a job we've done as judges, and our writings, and all that, and our quality, and all that kind of stuff. But we all know that the reality is that elections sometimes turn on just scurrilous, made-up stuff. I imagine that's one of the reasons why Mark's getting out of the whole area, right? And that's unfortunate. And that's really you know, it's a reality. You hope it doesn't happen. When it happens and good people either are not elected to office or they don't even bother to run for office because that's what happens in elections or that's what people are afraid are going to happen in elections, that's a terrible thing for democracy. And so you like, you know, that not to happen. You hope it doesn't happen. You know, I think the election between me and Alyssa, one of the things that you know, it's been an above-board election. I haven't gone negative. I'm not aware that she's gone a negative. If anybody is aware of that, let me know. But even the discussion here today, look, we're not throwing allegations at each other. We're talking about philosophy. Yeah. We're talking about high-level things. This is the way elections should be. Unfortunately, they're not. And honestly, that's a reflection of us as a society. The fact that we let that happen, the fact that we let politicians do this and we let the winners win because of stuff like that, that's on us as voters. So I don't know that there is any sort of due process or any sort of burden of proof here. I have to make my case to the voters in, you know, the best way that I think is that I can do, and hopefully they judge me on the merits.
Thank you.
Can I just quickly add one thing? Sorry, give me more time. I keep thinking of more things to say. But if there are allegations made in this or any race, our system counts on the press, who I'm happy to have them here today, to be the ones to investigate those allegations and offer facts about whether those allegations are true or not. And that's what I'd be counting on if something like that were to happen. Folks who will look at the facts and the evidence, investigate the issue so that people have some guidance rather than just hearing some rumor thrown out there and deciding based on that.
Thank you, Judge. Any other questions? Anyone else? We're right at our time. I will tell you that I'll end where I started, and that is we are blessed in this state to have both Judge Kadish and Judge Tao join us today and to be willing to throw their hats in the ring, to sacrifice. They both have full caseloads, and at the same time trying to run in a judicial race is very difficult. And I say God bless you both for your efforts on behalf of all Nevadans. I hope you'll join me in a round of applause for these wonderful people.